there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on Vermont Edition. And I wanted to let you know that what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Short and sweet, right to the good stuff. Thank you.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. Here in our region, we are getting ready for the icy chill of a New England winter. The ponds will freeze, the air will crackle with cold, and some of us will temporarily forget what it feels like to have warm toes. But farther north in Greenland, ice is a year-round event. At least it is for now. Due to global warming, ice is melting in the Arctic and affecting people all across the globe. This ice holds our planet's history. And when you drill far down into it, you can learn what the world and the climate was like hundreds of thousands of years ago. In a new book published this year, the geologist Paul Bierman shares the fascinating story of studying Greenland's ice sheet. He uncovers secrets from our past that can teach us about our future. Paul Bierman is a professor of environmental science at UVM and the Gund Institute for Environment. He's published in the journals Science and Nature, and he lives in Burlington. His book is called When the Ice is Gone, What a Greenland Ice Core Reveals About Earth's Tumultuous History and Perilous Future. Paul, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. And listeners, you can join this conversation as well, especially if maybe you are a student of Paul Bierman at UVM. We always love hearing student stories. Or maybe you have questions about our warming climate and what we can learn from the ice that is on our planet still today. You can give us a call at 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Paul, I asked you just before the show if you could start us out by reading one paragraph. It's from the very end of the prologue of the book. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind doing that.
Absolutely. All right. Then I can give you some context.
Oh, that'd be great.
So every December, for as long as I can remember, the radio station where I live, that's the public radio station where I live, has played the same recording. It's of an older Vermonter with a thick New England accent reading Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This year, when I heard the story and noted that the grass on my front lawn was still green and bare of snow, I started to wonder if we, the people of this planet, are a collective Scrooge. If so, then the Camp Century Ice Core could be the ghost of Christmas past. But then I thought, what about the frozen plant fossils, so well preserved in the frozen soil beneath the ice? Although ancient, those bits of moss, twigs, and leaves could well be the ghost of Christmas yet to come. A disturbing way for us to envision Greenland's future. A future when the ice is gone again.
All right. There's lots in there that I'm very excited to talk to you about today, Paul. But first, what was that public radio station that you were referring to?
Well, that would be Vermont Public.
Oh, wow. Great. Of course, I picked out the one section of your book that's about us. So,
which I listen to online and on the radio when I'm cooking dinner and breakfast.
Thank you. We did not hire you to say that. So tell us a little bit first about Camp Century. The samples that you studied came from this Cold War era experiment by the U.S. Army that's called Camp Century. What is it?
Yeah, it's this fantastical army base in the Greenland ice sheet. And there's a long evolution to get there. But in 1959, the Army started excavating long trenches about 130 miles from the edge of the Greenland ice sheet. Those were 30 or 40 feet deep. They roofed over them with metal and blew snow on that. And then they put prefabricated insulated buildings inside them. The longest trench was about 1,000 feet long. They called it Main Street. And there were side trenches coming off the side. They held barracks. They held dining rooms. They held latrines. They held 200 men.
Wow.
And they held a nuclear reactor for heat and power. So this was a pretty radical thing, 1959, 1960, the first portable nuclear reactor, the first base of that size inside an ice sheet. And it was a response to the Cold War and the worry about the Soviets coming over the top.
And when you say ice sheet, is that exactly what it sounds like? Are we just in a frozen tundra right now? Going to place us in this landscape.
In Greenland. Okay. So if you're on the edge of Greenland, there is tundra. There is tundra vegetation. There are small plants. There's things that might be ankle to knee high and lots of insects. Once you get onto the ice sheet itself, it's very different. The surface of the ice sheet is snow. then as that snow has sat there for years and more snow has piled on top of it, it becomes what we call fern, which is what you can imagine, oh, the end of winter in Vermont, very dense. Sometimes it has water in it if it warms up. And then below there, it becomes solid ice. And at the center of the ice sheet, it's 2 miles thick. Wow. At the edges, it's much thinner. There is really nothing living on the ice. You had a little bit of algae and the occasional animal that wanders up around the edges. But people, animals are all restricted to the area around the edges that's rock and soil.
So wait, 2 miles. You can drill down 2 miles and it'll still be solid ice.
Yes. And just below that 2 mile bit, you'll hit what we call the base of the ice sheet, which is rock. And in some places, that rock is covered with soil and sediment.
Fascinating. Okay. And that's what we're going to dive into. We already have some calls here for you. 800-639-2211 if you have questions for geologist Paul Bierman about his work in Greenland. Bob in Rutland is up first. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. I was wondering if Dr. Bierman was going to point out, he obviously will later on, where he did is conducted some of the drilling and so on. But was it anywhere near Thule, Greenland, where you mentioned the Cold War era back in, well, even late 1968, the U.S. accidentally detonated 4 plutonium hydrogen bombs in that area and contaminated, you know, deeply into the ground quite a bit of the earth.
Yeah, so there are a couple things I can talk to on that. The first one is Camp Century was supplied by the air base at Thule. It was 138 miles from the edge of the ice, probably 150 from Thule. And Thule was built in 1950 by the Air Force to have a set long runways, bombers, fighter planes, even closer to the former Soviet Union there. The crash you mentioned in Thule was the crash of a B-52. Luckily, none of those atomic weapons actually detonated, but they splattered radioactive material all over the ice. There was a major cleanup. Much of that radioactive material that was not cleaned up is sitting at the bottom of the bay near Thule. So there's a lot of contamination there. There luckily is very little on land. So the exposure to people is low, but the exposure to marine organisms there is really high. Mm. So yes, Thule was a huge base, 10,000 people at its peak. And imagine that far above the Arctic Circle.
Wow. Okay, so thank you, Bob, for calling in. And let's go back to Camp Century. I really loved learning about what life was like at this camp from your book. And there was one particular scientist who you brought up a couple of times named Dr. Bader, yes. I believe it is. And I saw in another interview that you did about this book where you said that you really wished you knew him. Could you tell us about him?
Yeah, this fellow's name, Henri Bader. He was trained in Switzerland, born, I think, 1909, got his doctorate in mineralogy, a very standard geologic sort of background where he studied the crystals. And so he made a leap after he got out of graduate school to snow and ice and figured it was about the same. He was just looking at crystals of ice. And he worked for the Swiss in avalanche prevention and understanding. And then in 1938, he very quickly left Switzerland for Argentina. And 38 is probably a pivotal year with the expansion of the Nazi Germany. A year later, Poland was invaded. And so he spent the war, both in South America and then in Curaçao, off the coast of South America. And within 2 weeks of the end of the war, ended up at Rutgers University and ended up in the employ of the U.S. military, which may have been no accident. Curaçao was one of the major places where oil was refined for the Allies and had a phosphorus mine that he worked in that produced weapons-grade phosphorus. It's hard to know. That's sort of lost to the fog of time. But Bader lands in the U.S. 1945, is soon employed by the military to understand snow and ice because what the military realized during World War II is airplanes were crashing on the Greenland ice sheet and it was really hard to get people off. And they needed to understand how to move around the ice sheet. They needed to understand snow. This was all based on military readiness and the military ability to move in the field. So Bader, in many ways, invented the field of snow and ice science, and especially from a physics and a chemistry point of view. He's the one who envisioned these deep ice cores. He's the one who helped the Army understand the need for sort of basic technical engineering knowledge. And so absolutely a fascinating man. He had some personal traits which absolutely intrigued me that I would love to have met him.
Yeah, it sounds like he was just also a really good guy.
Yeah, no, he supported at the time when there was rampant anti-Semitism, he supported a guy named Jerry Wasserberg as a student who went on to date moon rocks and is probably one of the most famous scientists for dating planetary rocks. He supported a number of lesbian women in his employ. At the same time, there was this lavender scare that meant as a homosexual, you weren't supposed to be employed by the government in the 1950s, but he did. So he also employed black men, black engineers. So a very unusual sort of profile for a scientist in the 1950s. I haven't met him. I didn't meet him, but a really spooky thing happened about a year ago where I had asked the National Archives for a series of recordings, and the National Archives, after COVID, takes weeks to months. This was almost a year after I made the request. And in my inbox came a recording from a Voice of America episode that Bader was part of, and I could actually hear his voice.
Oh, wow.
So long dead, died in the late 90s. There was his voice on my computer. And when I do in-person talks, I play that piece of tape because it's a wonderful Swiss-German accent describing why you core ice sheets and what you're going to get from them.
Wow. That's amazing. And you continue to boost the importance of public radio and the power of sound throughout this interview. So again, I thank you, even though we did not ask you to do that.
I should have brought a tape of that. It's amazing.
Next time we have you on. Okay, so the U.S. Army was drilling deep down into the ice, these ice cores, and you gained access to them. How did that come about?
Sure. So the bit of a story on the ice core, so I'll digress, that
Please.
We had never drilled a deep ice core, anybody in the world, until Camp Century. And so the military did something that was a complete first. They had no idea how to drill ice cores, and they figured it out. And they went 1,350 meters into the ice, and they didn't stop. They kept going when they got to the bottom, and they collected 11.5 feet, 3.4 meters of frozen soil.
Hmm. And they just sucked that up, that tube of soil?
They brought it back up, just like they brought back all the ice. And in 1966, they actually took the ice to the Pentagon, and they did another wonderful trick that I could have done in your studio today, where they dropped a piece of ice core into a glass of Coca-Cola, and then they served it to the generals. And that was ice from 2,000 years ago, when the time when Christ was born, is what they said. And the New York Times covered this marvelously. And it was a publicity stunt, but they got the first deep ice core. From that came the first climate record that takes us back 100,000 years in Earth's climate. And that was spectacular in 1969. That changed everybody's thinking about how the Earth worked. And then the core, people sort of lost interest, and that bottom frozen sediment vanished. And it didn't end up in Denver with the rest of the U.S. ice cores in 1994. And myself and most of the other members of the ice core community just went, okay, it's gone. It was 1966. What do we expect? And then the Danes refound it.
The Danes. What were they doing with it?
That's a really good question. the core made its way to Denmark, probably was sent there by perhaps slightly a retiring man who had a lot of Danish colleagues is probably the best way. And it got lost in one of their freezers. But to the Danes'
credit— As many things do in many of our own freezers.
Yeah, you can imagine the things in the back of your freezer. But to the Danes' credit, they had kept this core frozen for 30 years and in perfect shape. And so I was invited to a small meeting of people to discuss how to deal with this and other the bottoms of deep ice cores in 2019. And then the Danes very graciously provided us the top and the bottom of that frozen sediment. And we organized a team, was centered on the University of Vermont, but had a dozen members from around the world who worked on that sediment. We got a fistful. That's all we had for a dozen people in their labs to work on. So we took that material apart very painstakingly. We saved every last little bit so we could share it. And the really astounding piece of this that I do talk about in the book, but to me as a scientist is the only spine-tingling moment I think I've ever had doing science, was when we melted that core and we were running it through a set of brass sieves to get the sand away from the silt, away from the cobbles. And it was a hot July afternoon. It was sort of staring at this bin of water, and there were little things floating in it. And I looked at my two colleagues and I said, I think there's plants in here. And they looked at me with one of those expressions. I can't say the word on the radio, of course. But basically, you're nuts. And I pipetted up a few of these, put them in a little petri dish and handed them to Drew Christ, who was a postdoc working on this, and said, put this under the microscope. And he uttered another series of things I can't say on the radio when he looked under the microscope. But we were all spent the afternoon staring down the microscope, little twigs, pieces of leaves, pieces of moss. And we had never in our wildest dreams expected the bottom of an ice core from Greenland to have these fossils. And that day changed everything.
And spell this out for us. The reason that was fascinating was that it signaled that this ice core hadn't been ice forever, that there was a time when it didn't exist, when there were plants growing.
Exactly. So that meant that there was no Greenland ice sheet at Camp Century. So 1,300 meters of ice, nearly a mile of ice, had vanished sometime in the past, so that a tundra ecosystem full of little bits of willow and poppy and mosses and spike mosses and things that you would find in the Arctic
today. The plants we know today.
The plants we know today from the Arctic were all there.
Hmm.
What we didn't know then is when. And so in our lab, we made measurements. In a lab in Utah, Tammy Rittenhauer made measurements. And in the end, we concluded that it had to be within the last million years. And then when Tammy got her measurements...
That feels broad, Paul.
It feels broad. That feels broad, but it's actually not so broad.
Okay.
Because some people would have said, oh, this is 2.5, 3, 4 million years ago before the ice sheet formed. But it wasn't. It was much more recent. And then Tammy's lab nailed it at 400,000 years ago. Mm. And that's a really important time because that's an analog we use for climate change today that says we know the world was warmer 400,000 years ago. We know it was probably about the temperature we are right now, sort of a degree and a half Celsius warmer than pre-industrial revolution. And yet carbon dioxide then was far lower than today. So that then it was 280 ppm. Today it's 420 ppm. So when you realize that Greenland's ice can melt all on its own with a lot less carbon dioxide than we have in the atmosphere, and this was a warm period in the past, and the ice in northwestern Greenland had disappeared, that's not a great prognosis for the future.
Mm-mm.
And that's the real visceral impact of this. We can talk about climate models. I can teach them all the time. When you show somebody a picture of a fossil that comes from nearly a mile of ice, below nearly a mile of ice, you catch their attention.
Mm.
And then this summer, we found very similar fossils under 2 miles of ice in the dead center of Greenland. So the finding fossils underneath Greenland has become a little more common now.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's probable that as more deep ice cores hit the bottom, they're going to find more of this. And it tells us of a time that mirrors the title in the book of when the ice was gone.
So, Paul, listening to you discuss the fact that this ice has melted once before, part of my brain was saying, even though saying it out loud sounds a little bit nonsensical, but, you know, if the ice has melted before and then it came back, like, are we going to be okay? What if the ice melts now, but then we can bring it back again?
Yeah, that's a tough question. And the answer to it is it's going to be really tough for us to bring it back because we have so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So this is something that when I'm teaching climate and people refer to as a tipping point. And when we lose Greenland, when Greenland's ice starts to shrink and starts to lower, I assume many people in the audience here have climbed up Mount Mansfield or Camel's Hump and mm-hmm. know that you get colder as you get higher. So the top of the Greenland ice sheet now is over 10,000 feet elevation. It's really cold up there. As that ice sheet starts to melt, it lowers. And you have this feedback that kicks in of, hey, I'm lower. It's warmer. Melt more. Warmer. Lower. Melt more. And so once you kick that over the edge, then the ice sheet shrinks to nothing. To get it back, you actually have to chill the climate beyond where we are today so that you can build up an ice sheet at sea level. And that's really tough. So nature did that just fine, but nature didn't have 420 ppm carbon dioxide in the atmosphere warming the Earth. And that's the conundrum here. So the only way we are going to keep Greenland is to cut carbon emissions dramatically and probably to get carbon out of the atmosphere eventually. We have a little bit of time. We don't have time to cut the emissions. We have a little bit of time to get it out of the atmosphere. But that failing, Greenland is going to melt. And even though you might be saying, oh, Greenland, it's 2,000, 3,000 miles away. I don't need to worry. In fact, it's got really long arms, and those long arms are sea level. And so as Greenland's ice melts, it's sitting on land, and every drop of water that's in the ice on land is flowing into the global ocean, and the ocean is rising. And it's sea level rise that is really going to be the mark of Greenland on our world. It's also a giant reflector up in the Arctic sending back sunlight, right? It's a big white surface. And so as sunlight comes in, it bounces off that surface, and that keeps us cooler. Once you lose the Greenland ice sheet, it's replaced by dark rock and trees and forest and tundra that absorb more of that solar radiation. So there's a feedback there too, which is why I think you could ask just about every climate scientist, and they would say it is crucial to keep Greenland's ice sheet. It's going to matter for the climate. It's going to matter for sea level. The way I like to put it is if you melted all of Greenland, it represents about 25 feet of sea level rise. So think about your favorite beach. Now think about your favorite beach with 25 feet more water on it. And maybe you go to Cape Cod or the rocky coast of Maine. They're underwater, right? Boston, New York, New Orleans, Venice, all the world's great cities with 25 feet of water, great cities around the ocean, are all underwater.
Hmm. So even though Greenland feels far away from us here in the Northeast, it's really not so far at all.
It is not far at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 5-hour flight on an old C-130, but it's not very far.
Okay, I don't want to do that, but let's take some calls. We have David calling in from Thetford. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I worked for the Cold Regions Lab in Hanover, New Hampshire for 31 years. And also at the lab were two of the engineers who were at Camp Century, and they were completely responsible for the engineering advances that allowed them to obtain the core, that core that Dr. Bierman is talking about. So I was in Greenland at a different drilling site in the early 80s, and it was able to, I wasn't doing the drilling, but I was able to watch some of it, and it was pretty fun to see. Anyway, I'm hoping that Dr. Bierman will mention the names of the engineers. And if he doesn't, I can tell you their names. They're both gone now, but they were critical to the drilling program.
Dr. So, Bierman, do you know these names?
I'm going to take a guess. Was it Herb Uyeda and Lyle Hansen?
And Don Garfield.
And Don,
those
yep.
Three.
Thank you, David, for calling in. And that's so fascinating that you were there as well and watching this ice coring going on.
No, it's that those are amazing men. And in fact, the photograph of the Coca-Cola and ice at the Pentagon has Hansen in there. And Uyeda has an amazing, I presume you know this, but he has an amazing backstory. As a Japanese-American, he was interned during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And then went on to work for the Army. Doing the drilling. And there's a fantastic online oral history with Uyeda being interviewed. That's if you haven't heard that, it's just Google it and you will find it. And it's wonderful because you can hear his voice describing the ice coring.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, David, thank you so much for calling in. We have Jack in Morrisville on the line as well. Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. So I read this book by Al Gore, and he mentioned that they could read the ice core samples much like the ring of a tree. So on a heavy winter, you'd see a narrow ring or a heavy ring, and on a light winter, you'd see a narrow ring, for example. But what they noticed was as the Earth warmed, it got to a certain point where the currents weren't affected as strongly by the climate, and ice age occurred quickly after that, they saw that by the widening of the rings, quickly after the narrowing of the rings. Is that been proven?
Jack, thank you for your call. Paul Bierman, do you know?
Yeah, so there's so much we can get out of ice cores. We absolutely can get a signal for climate and watch Earth slip into a glaciation. In fact, the Camp Century core was the first one to do that. It wasn't at depth based on the thickness of the ice layers. You can do that near the surface, but you know, within hundreds to a few thousands of years, that signal blurs. But you can do it with chemistry. You can do it with isotopes in the ice. There's some amazing other things you can pull out of ice cores. You can pull out records of when volcanoes erupted. You can reconstruct the smelting of lead in the past, going back thousands of years, so you can see the rise and fall of the Roman Empire based on how much lead they were smelting. There are amazing things one can do with these records well beyond climate to understand other environmental parameters.
Wow. Well, thanks, Jack, for calling in with that question. 800-639-2211. If you have questions about ice coring or what the ice in Greenland can teach us about our planet and global warming today, we're speaking with Paul Bierman, who is a UVM professor and the author of a new book called When the Ice is Gone. You have been working on this research for many years now. You've written about it in academic journals and for an audience of scientists. This book is an attempt to reach a much more general audience. What was it like trying to dive into this material with that very different audience in mind?
Oh, it was a transition. Although I've spent a lot of my life trying to figure out how to communicate science to the public.
Yeah.
I think it is absolutely critical as scientists that we speak not to other scientists only, but to speak to everybody. This book came about 2021. We published a paper, and about a week later, I got a phone call from one of the senior editors at W.W. Norton who said, "We want you to write a book about this." And I kind of laughed and said, "Okay, I've written two textbooks, and I've written some small essays, but I've never written a book like this." She's like, "We'll help you. Don't worry." So I actually, in one summer, typed out the first draft and thought it was great and sent it off, and it came back about 3 months later, completely hacked up. I think 2 out of the 8 chapters, she's like, these are make great essays. They make a lousy book.
Oh, get rid of them. Feeling.
So it took 2 more drafts to do that. But it was actually way more satisfying than the academic papers I write, and in part because I could dive into the history. So, for those of you listening, this is really a history book in many ways. It's got science in it, but it's got science, I hope, at a level that anybody can understand. But it really is an exploration of the environmental history of Greenland going back to the native Greenlanders and then right through various expeditions in Greenland and then with a focus on the U.S. military. And their discovery of the importance of climate change in the 1950s, which kind of breaks the narrative, right? We think about climate change as left-leaning, as blue states. But in fact, one of the most conservative organizations in the country, the U.S. military, was the first to deeply investigate climate change. And they cared because in the 1950s and late 40s, the climate appeared to be warming. And they were worried, can we still land planes on the ice? Can we still run tracked vehicles over the ice? Will it get messy and sloppy and reduce our ability to travel? And they actually paid for the bulk of this ice core because of that, because they wanted to look back in time and say, is this natural? And this was right at the beginning in the 1950s of people thinking about carbon dioxide and global warming. And the military was right at the forefront. So I was trying to write a book that emphasized the importance of taking care of our climate without falling into the sort of typical doom and gloom climate book that screams the end is near, with a little bit more background and subtlety and this realization that, in fact, the U.S. military and its history was integral to the whole understanding of climate change we have today.
Did you have somebody in your life, and maybe it was the editors that you brought up, who you would run passages by, somebody who is not a scientist, who'd say, hey, does this make any sense to you?
Oh, yeah. There are sections in the book that started out as 4 pages long and came back to me with, condense this to 2 paragraphs. It reads like a textbook. And I learned.
And you're like, I love textbooks.
Yeah. No, you learn over time how to rethink and rephrase. And so by the end of the book, I was writing in the way they wanted me to write. But yeah, it was an amazing exercise for somebody in their 60s to learn a new trick.
What role did your graduate students and your colleagues at UVM play in this?
Hugely. We had a group of 3 graduate students working on this project at the master's level, and Nico Pedrile, who's a close colleague in the geology department working on this, doing the geochemistry. And we have over 40 people around the world working on this project. So we were the primary scientists on this, and we got the samples and then we distributed them all around the world. So I think we have 5 countries represented, about 2 dozen laboratories, 40 people, 8 graduate students. So it's been an international project that has also a big outreach component. The book was part of that outreach component, our website, and there's a movie made by a woman named Kathy Kasich in California that is going to come out within the next 6 months that documents what we did and what we found.
Wow. Well, we just actually got an email from one of your old students. They write, hi, Paul, James, your old Cosmo Lab student here. I'm wondering about the future of earth science as a discipline. All these disciplines stay in their lanes, but how do we link social justice and eco-psychology to earth science? How do we turn this knowledge we have into action?
I would say that's exactly why I wrote this book. The intent with the book is to say we can learn from the science. We need scientists. We need engineers. We need to study the planet. We need to cross disciplines, absolutely. And I think this project is probably the best example of discipline crossing that I've done in my career. I mean, I'm working with people who analyze DNA. I'm working with people who analyze plant waxes, people who understand dating of rocks, people understand fossils and pollen and all these various things. And we all work together. We have monthly meetings with 20 or 30 people talking about things that, 3 or 4 people in that meeting know exactly what's going on and the rest are learning. So I think the crossing discipline is key. I think we can learn about the importance of diversity of thought from what Bader did and how this, project has been working for 50 years now. Like that. But the book was really an attempt, and especially the last chapter of the book, to broaden to this is why it matters. This is why we have to look at the science in a social context. And if we're going to affect change in this world and keep the absolute worst from happening with climate change, we have to get going quickly at this point.
Yeah. Paul, you have another section of the bookmarks I know you wanted to read for us today. Set it up for us.
So this is almost at the end of the last chapter. And this is my optimistic look forward, because people who know me know that I'm basically an optimist. And it reflects on Bader, so I'll just read it. In 1972, and Bader was long retired by then, Bader nominated Wasserberg, he's the guy who dates moon rocks, for the Day Medal, one of geoscience's highest honors. Bader's nomination was short, funny, and self-deprecating. Wasserberg's response was humble, but more than 50 years later, it carries a message that gives me hope for our planet, even as the climate dramatically warms. And this is the quote from Wasserberg. The future of our profession, our hope for advancement, will probably not be found in this hall here tonight filled with many dignitaries, but rather around the corner in an inexpensive bar or restaurant where there will be half a dozen or so very bright young people drunk on the excitement of science and full of energy and imagination. And my takeaway from that, and I do this when I teach, is to say, you know, my generation and the generation before left you a mess. But if you look at Camp Century, you look at what the military did, you look at the drillers like Uwida and Hansen that we talked about and Don Garfield, they invented from scratch the idea of drilling an ice core, and they did it. And they did it at a time when no one had any clue that you could do it. They built Camp Century. They put a reactor under the ice. This was exceptional stuff in the early 60s, and we went to the moon, right? And if we can do that, then human ingenuity, especially among young, excited people, is the solution to our climate crisis. And that's not saying that I'm not part of it and my generations are not part of it, but the new and radical ideas are most likely to come out of young people. And so I take that as a real encouragement, and it's why I'm teaching and still teaching, that I think it's – I don't mean it as a heavy burden to folks. I mean it as an inspiration of think outside the box, do something, be radical. It's okay, because that's what we're going to need for the future.
Yeah. It's a great message to share. Thank you for sharing that with our listeners. Paul, we have just a couple minutes left here, and if you will indulge me, I have a couple questions for you about what it is like to be extremely cold and how you prepare for the work that you have done over the years in Greenland. I am a child of the Mid-Atlantic. I thrive in the humidity like a little lizard. Tell me how you get ready for one of these big expeditions.
Well, I'm also a child of the Mid-Atlantic, but I got out of there. It was way too hot and humid for me. Nope. So, actually, I have spent very little time in Greenland when it's cold. We go up in the summer. So my work in Greenland, we did not collect these ice cores, right? Mm-hmm. I was not even born when they started making Camp Century.
Sure.
And I was 5 years old when they pulled the core out. So we have been there in the summer. The latest I've been there is September, and it was cold in September. And we were off the ice. We were just around the edges. So
what are we talking? How cold?
32 and pouring rain and snow.
Ugh.
It was probably it's way colder than I've been in Vermont at 10 below. Because we were soaked the whole time and had to work with our hands. We're using surveying gear and all this sort of thing. The summertime up there can be deceptively warm. So at 50, 60 degrees and sunny, you pray for the wind not to stop. Because the minute the wind stops, the bugs come out. And my best example of that there's a little piece in the book on this one, is it was one of those really warm days. There was no wind. It might have even hit 60. And we had to hike about 5 miles out from a camp, and we were carrying packs and all that. And we got really hot, and I saw a pond. Little pond in the ice. The ice was on one side, but it was open water. And I'm like, okay, I've got to swim in Greenland. I have to tick that off my bucket list. And, you know, so I stripped off, I jumped in this little pond, and Tom, the guy with me, is like, no, I'm not going in there. I'm going to freeze. And that water was literally 32 degrees because there were ice chunks on the side of the pond. And I got out and I screamed because it was so cold. But then I was screaming because I was completely swarmed by the bugs at that point. So as quickly as I could get everything back on and run down the trail. I was running down the trail. That's the coldest I've ever been in Greenland, was swimming in that. But, but the people working on the ice, they still live in tents, many of them. Multiple sleeping bags, foam pads, all that sort of thing.
And looking at the photos of folks back in the Camp Century days, the folks who with these big wool coats on, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure their technology for staying cold was very different than what it is today.
Yeah, but the Camp Century folks had heated barracks, heated dining halls. That's why in some ways it was really easy to drill that ice core, because they had so much support. Wow. You know, they were in the trench, but then they could go and sleep someplace where it was 70.
Well, I'm happy for that for them. Well, Paul Bierman, it has been fascinating talking to you today. Thank you so much for telling us about your research. One last question for you. What comes next for you? Are you still learning from these ice cores, or have you moved on to a new project?
Oh, no, we're still learning from these cores. We had a meeting yesterday of the eight of us sort of leaders on this and talking about what papers are we publishing. So it's back to the academic stuff. But I've been still writing essays about this and thinking about it and thinking about maybe the next popular science book. We'll see.
Paul Bierman is the author of When the Ice is Gone, What a Greenland Ice Core Reveals About Earth's Tumultuous History and Perilous Future. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.